Ladies and gentlemen, we've lost our audience. We've reached that point in the program where the committee is larger than the audience. I believe Trustee Coleman will be joining us soon, but we have a full composite once Trustee Coleman returns, because we're joined also by our colleague Trustee Muir, who's at the table with us as well. Let me begin by calling the order. I've sort of been stalling for Trustee Coleman, but I'm sure he'll be here shortly.
Trustee Robert Bowie.
Here.
Trustee Wheeler Coleman. Trustee Matthew Holmes.
Here.
Trustee Robert Marshall.
Here.
Trustee Mark Strauss.
Here.
Trustee Tim Struthers.
Here.
Committee Chair John Butler.
Here. Mr. Blakemore, can you verify that we have a quorum and appropriate notification of this meeting has been issued?
Mr. Chair, you have a quorum, and this meeting has been called and has been called in compliance with the Illinois Open Meetings Act.
I'm going to ask for a motion to approve the agenda, but I would propose that we strike from the agenda item number 10, because Mr. Blakemore and Dr. Long have shared with me their view that these are very important matters, not to be rushed, and we are in somewhat of a schedule crunch today. So I'm going to ask for a motion to approve this meeting agenda with item 10 removed.
So moved.
Second.
There's a motion. There's a second. Trustee Coleman, there's been a motion on the table to amend the agenda, or to move to approve the agenda with item 10 struck, so that we can have a more extensive and detailed conversation of that at a later time. So is there any discussion on that motion? Seeing none, all those in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Any opposition? Seeing none, the agenda is approved. You have before you, at my sincere apologies, somewhat late, were the minutes of this meeting. This is entirely my fault. I exercise a bit of excessive micromanagement over the minutes of these meetings, I waited a little longer than usual. With that, are there any corrections or concerns about the minutes?
I move to approve the micromanagement minutes.
Okay.
Second.
Is there a second? All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposition? Seeing none, the minutes are approved. In the interest of time, I won't make any comments. Are there any interest from the public to make any statements?
Mr. Chair, I have not received any notice or request.
Then we have our University Advisory Committee representatives here. Do you have any interest in speaking to the committee? You'll be speaking to us later.
Yeah, I will hold my comments until later.
Okay, Ms. Nicholson.
At the risk of sounding like a broken record, and I may be caught repeating this at a later meeting as well, but since I've been stepped in the role of Operating Staff Council President, I've been impressed with the value placed on shared governance by the administration. And while we can always do better, and Greg and I have received comments to that effect, of course, I did want to express my appreciation for the inclusive practices and discussions. And as we continue to progress through the Constitution and bylaw revision, and we begin to codify the process by which we create and maintain policy, it's my hope and expectation that shared governance will have a role in policy approval, and because it is important to be inclusive and consider the input of all constituencies when discussing an IU policy. Thank you.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much for that comment. All right, we'll move then to the first item, and I'll turn the microphone over to Mr. Blakemore.
Actually, this is an item for the provost.
And actually, I'm going to call on Vice Provost Krishnamurthy to come to the microphone and discuss this item.
Slides, and can somebody load them?
Morelli, why don't you take my seat so you can actually see the slides.
I have to stand up so I can see, if you don't mind.
You'll need a microphone, though.
Okay. Let me do this.
Yeah, why don't you take my seat?
Yeah, swap.
Oh, okay. Maybe that's a good idea. These are some simple requests we have. So in refining the Board of Trustees regulations regarding some of the language related to appointments. And three of them I have. First one, if it moves. Yes. The first one is related to visiting faculty appointments. These are individuals hired temporarily to cover for tenure track faculty duties. So if, you know, if they go on leave or if there's a search going on, it takes a whole year, sometimes longer. So the current regulation says their appointment is limited to a year. So the request is to extend it for 2 years. So this is the rationale. So number one, that CMS allows faculty to go on leave for, you know, 2 years. So there are such cases right now. So it is inefficient. It's for us to hire somebody as visiting for a year and train them, and they do teaching and research, and then you let them go, and then you hire again somebody else for the second year. It's not as efficient. The second reason is kind of related. So if somebody retires from the tenure track or they leave, it takes a whole year to do a search, and at that time you hire somebody to fill in as visiting. At the end of that, you know, time period, if next faculty also leaves, and then you cannot retain that individual you hired as, you know, temporary to fill in that role for visiting, so you have to let that individual go and hire somebody else new. So this happened in my own department, engineering, last year. And lastly, in some disciplines, it's harder to recruit faculty, and we're experiencing, say, for example, in nursing, this is happening more and more.
Music education
and a lot of those. And so it is attractive to hire doctoral candidates who are in the last stage of the dissertation, give them a whole year, and they can complete, but at times it takes longer, so it spills over to second year. So this is the rationale for those. So, questions on these?
Are there questions for Dr. Krishnamurthy?
Yeah.
I have a question. It actually applies to all of these. So these relate to terms and conditions of employment. In some cases, they would imply have implications for collective bargaining.
Yes, agreements. I'm coming to.
Are we free to alter our regulations outside of the collective bargaining process?
And I can respond to that. And the subsequent recommendations were actually, they are from the unions. So we are at the negotiations, so these things came up. So that's a reason also in the opening sentences, if you saw from our side, from NIU side, as well as union side, the same requests, you know, they came up. Secondly, these changes also, they make it consistent with collective bargaining agreements. So, and Laura is also here. Laura Alexander, she's the senior associate vice president for HR. She would also add, some of her definitions are not really consistent. So these kinds of definitions for the rest of the state universities. So it's the other reason also. I'll come to that also next. Speaking of, you know, this classification, visiting, and you may ask, how many of these do we have right now? For this year, there's 19, you know, visiting faculty.
Morali, yeah. I think you're going to move through the three classifications.
Yeah. Okay. The next one is temporary appointment. So this is the request that came from the union, and the management side concurs with that also. So the temporary appointments are instructors. They are in the union, and their role is to
UPI.
Yeah,
the existing
UPI.
Union, long-term contract.
Yeah,
And the Board of Trustees regulation on this from early, from 90s, it says they can be appointed, you know, for only 5 years for consecutive appointments. And after that, and, you know, that needs a special approval from the president, president to the designee, and the designee to me for continuing them. And so the request is to remove this limit for the simple reason, by definition, these are already there, you know, temporary appointments annually renewed. And number two, the collective bargaining agreements take care of the appointments and their duration. So renewing these appointments and going through the process, there's a lot of transactions involved. And lastly, from the union side, the seniority is important for them, but you cannot have somebody for 5 years and say you let them go and then we will hire them later after, you know, a year later, and so break in service. So the seniority in their rosters is important. Some of our instructors have been here, you know, 10 years, 15 years, and they do a great service for NIU. So this is really transactional recommendation from the union as well as from us. Questions on?
Trustee Muir.
I do have a question.
Yeah, please.
I am concerned about taking a time limitation off of something that's called temporary. So it's one or the other. Either it's temporary, and if so, I think that we require some type of specificity as to what does that mean. Or if they're not temporary and they're permanent, then why are we still using that language? So I have a problem with the juxtaposition of language.
Exactly. And let me respond to the temporary matter. It's actually all these union instructors' contracts are annually renewed.
I'm having a difficulty with language.
Yeah.
All right. I have difficulty with the terminology of temporary, which has a meaning that is not permanent.
Mm-hmm.
And if we take any time limitation off of it, then it's ad infinitum. So I might be missing something here, Lisa. I don't know. But I'm just having an issue, a language issue, of using terminology called temporary and not having specificity of what does temporary mean.
I'm trying to clarify this the best I can.
I almost think in this context, temporary was probably introduced to signify non-tenure line, non-tenured,
yeah.
Which is really, it's not the most appropriate use of the word temporary.
I'm a big fan of language,
yeah.
You know, and precision of language. We should say what we mean, and if it's non-tenured, then that's what, non-tenured track, maybe that's what you need to call it. But if we have the opportunity to continue to rectify any indiscrepancies mm-hmm. that we have, let's take that
sure.
opportunity.
Absolutely. And so just as you were saying, I was recognizing the language issue. Maybe it's easy to say just instructors.
Yeah.
And this is right. their classification. This is their type of appointment.
Because that definitely carries with it the non-tenure line
exactly.
Meaning.
Maybe
and then it's one
it
word instead of a
do.
Lot of extra words.
That'd be fine with me.
Laura, yeah. That would be okay, yeah. So, anything else?
Trustee Boy.
Oh, I was thinking along the same line. I say, why not annual appointments?
Yeah, just however the language
not
can
annual,
be.
Because yeah. there is, it's an annual appointment. The answer needs to be
applied. So this is a committee, and this is an action item. We can recommend that the board approve these amendments. But at the same time, we can recommend that that you take another look at the title. I think the recommendation from Trustee Muir is to retitle this section and the appropriate sentences inside it to change it to instructor appointments.
Yeah.
Would anybody object to us bringing them back through the Academic Affairs, Student Affairs, and Personnel Committee, since these are personnel items and we have a meeting coming up on November 17th?
Not at all. I think that's appropriate. Okay, and I just, my question would be, the concept of automatic tenure still an issue, still a matter of concern that might affect this issue?
Automatic tenure?
I'm not sure what you're asking, I'm sorry.
Legal concept of automatic tenure.
So temporary employees.
I mean, the composition of the non-tenure track faculty workforce nationally has really changed. I'm very proud that we're an institution that does not rely in majority on contingent faculty who are not long-term employees. So the best practice nationally for instructors, meaning non-tenure aligned faculty who don't have research expectations and who teach the 4-4 teaching load, is actually moving towards rolling contracts, opportunities for advancement, because it's best for our students when they're part of this. So I think the concern you might be raising might no longer in the current environment be one that's raised very often.
Okay, that's fine. All right.
If I'm understanding, it was an implied tenure.
Yeah, I was just curious if that legal concept or principle was still hanging out there that could affect this distinction.
We'll certainly have better answer for you on November 17th.
Okay. So we'll move to the third category.
Third one was more of a language issue and consistent issue also, consistency issue also. So the current definition of adjuncts at NIU is really as non-employees, occasionally teach specialized courses, and they're not compensated, so they're volunteers. This is, again, this is not the national definition, even statewide definition. So the recommendation is to, you know, define them as adjuncts, as employees of NIU hired for less than 50% of time to teach, and I'll explain that, and they could be eligible to receive compensation. And I say less than 50% because the collective bargaining agreement says for instructors, if somebody is teaching 50% or more, they have to be in the collective bargaining unit. So if it is somebody is less than 50%, I'll give you some examples. You know, those who teach non-credit, you know, courses for the community school of the art, like piano and all those things for, you know, kids and adults and motorcycle safety and some of those non-credit, which are less than 50%. And occasionally some specialized courses, you can bring an industry expert to teach something in business or law for a semester for 25%, and some of those. And they should and they deserve to receive compensation. If somebody teaches, you know, teaches voluntarily, so they can do that too. And so here is the rationale. Some of you may recall last year that Associate Vice President of HR, Celeste Latham, she came and shared about the elimination of this affiliates category. And the affiliates category was used before for just accommodating all these outside of the new track faculty and collective bargaining instructors. Whoever was left over, they were affiliates. And so the adjunct faculty, the definition is right now, they should be volunteers. In the national definition, state definition, in other schools is these are adjunct faculty. So this is also an issue for us. So for those who teach non-credit in less than 50% time and for consistency, so this is recommended for your consideration.
Okay, questions? Trustee Strauss.
So the only issue I have is with the proposed addition, adjunct appointments for teaching credit courses shall be less than 50%, but it doesn't say 50% of what. So I think it would be advisable if it was clarified, if simply the language was clarified. I don't have a problem with the concept.
Okay. Trustee Muir.
I'm just concerned with making sure that we're clear on the methodology of compensation. So that if an adjunct, the other thing I'm really struggling with, adjunct doesn't go through the rigors of being an employee, usually. Am I correct on that?
Actually, if an adjunct is going to teach, they have to meet the HLC requirements for faculty qualifications. And in our graduate school, where we occasionally really would like people from the outside to serve on graduate committees, and generally that's done uncompensated, we still put them through a special review process.
Okay. I didn't mean the same rigors in terms of academic qualifications. I meant in terms of HR processes. But maybe I'm wrong on that. I just want to make sure in my mind that as we start to take a categorization of adjunct appointments that in the past had not received compensation, to put them in a category of compensation,
oh, which I can respond.
Then how do we, what methodology are we going to use through the HR process?
Yes.
To determine that level of compensation.
Yes. Two things here. Number one, so in terms of screening those employees, background check, and the paperwork and approvals, they will be same as any other employee. And number two, the compensation is really dictated by the discipline and the market rate. There's a lot of time that drives that.
And we have those processes in place for these employees now. It's just that these employees have been called affiliates. And with the elimination of the affiliates category, we're going to call them adjuncts, and adjuncts previously were by definition uncompensated.
And so this elimination of affiliates, it forced us to lump these into this instructor category. But instructors
but that has a very specific.
I know, specific for the union employees, so it's causing us confusion. So that's the reason to go to the standard definition of adjuncts and the same HR processes and the compensation rates and all those things.
So you're forward. Comfortable that we have the methodology?
Yes, absolutely.
Other questions from the committee? So then let me see if I can word a recommendation so this committee can take action on this item. The recommendation is that we forward this to the Academic Affairs, Student Affairs, and Personnel Committee with the changes that we have discussed here today with respect to changing temporary employments to instructors and the appropriate changes inside the body of that section, and that there be some clarification as to what 50% of what is. Are there any other recommendations?
And there was a recommendation to clarify those HR processes are followed same way.
Okay. So then we'll see this item again as a committee, but it'll be a different committee. So can
moved.
I have a motion to that effect? Can I have a second? There's a second. Is there any further discussion of the motion? Seeing none, in that case, all those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposition? Seeing none, the motion passes. Let me be a little more formal. I should have done this in the last item as well. So we're now considering a motion to amend the bylaws to create conditions for making public comments at our meetings. Let's begin with a motion to recommend this to the board, and then we'll have discussion. I have a motion for that recommendation. Is that appropriate as a order for this item?
It can be. We can have the discussion and then a motion.
All right, well, let's do that
if
then.
There are revisions that people would like to see. So.
All right, so why don't we then start with an explanation of this motion, and thank you, Dr. Krishnamurthy. Appreciate your time. Yes.
Since we're talking about a possible modification to the bylaws, we've got to have how many discussions on this matter?
There's a first introduction of the item, and then we can vote on it in the second.
We need a first reading.
Which we're attempting to do today.
First reading of the full board.
No, this is just us sort of working on it, constructing it. Hopefully, we'll recommend that something be proposed for first reading to the board. That's our objective today. So in that case, why don't we then have Mr. Blakemore give us some background or someone from your office.
Okay. Mr. Chair, members of the board, this is actually a follow-up to action that the board has already taken with respect to the governance of its meetings. The board took action within the last year or so based in part on an attorney general's opinion wherein we did not have a written policy related to whether in fact one was required to provide specific information in order to make a presentation to the board. There was an attorney general's opinion that indicated that you could not require personal information like the home address, telephone number, et cetera. That was not a practice that the board did, but we clarified that by eliminating that in terms of the form that the public needs to fill out in order to make its presentations to the board. Because of that, the Office of General Counsel took a more comprehensive review of what our policies and, quite frankly, what our practices were, and felt that it was important to do two things. One, we wanted to make certain that we were compliant with other Attorney General findings, opinions with respect to this issue. And then two, and more importantly, we wanted to clarify the roles, responsibilities, and expectations. So what we have proposed here is a more comprehensive appearances before the board section. I provided you a what we call red line, is actually highlighted in yellow, statement for your information and review. And what I'm going to do is summarize the major provisions of that proposal. One, we are requesting that the board make a statement in support of open discussion and observation of the public related to the business, you know, of the board, and so there's a comprehensive statement that is part of now Section 4 of appearances before the board. We specifically lay out the obligation of the board to provide opportunity for the public to observe the meeting, that you will from time to time streamline the meetings. Did I say that right? Stream the meetings, not streamline, streaming of the meetings. And that is especially true when you choose to meet in other locations within the university. So we wanted to make certain that if in the event that were done, you would still have the opportunity here in DeKalb to have the meeting. That has been the practice of the board. We wanted to memorialize that. We also wanted to make certain that there was an opportunity for the board, as is required by law, to record the meetings in the event that they wanted to. This morning was an example of the board fulfilling that legal obligation. But we wanted to be a little bit clearer about the parameters of that, and therefore you have a pretty detailed you have pretty detailed procedures related to that as part of the policy. The other thing that we have done here is the board has had a practice, but never had it in writing with respect to the amount of time that it would provide for public comment. And typically, institutions will want to provide the public notice, and you would want to have notice for yourself in terms of how you manage your meetings. We have taken what has been your practice, which is about 10 minutes before that you've provided. We've provided specific authority of the board chair to extend that for another 5 minutes. The board could always extend that public time in itself, but we are very specific about the 10 minutes plus the extension of time on the part of the chair within the discretion of the chair. We also, and this does not change our current practice at all, we now have a practice of allowing anyone from the public up to the time of the beginning of the meeting to actually register to actually speak. What we have done here, though, is expanded that by providing different options, so you don't have to come necessarily. We provide a website, we provide a telephone number, and so what we have done here is made registration a little easier for the public. And we have also provided opportunities for those persons who are disabled, and we have for your consideration in this, you would provide upon 2 days' notice more access if a person were disabled.
And so that is not something that is in the board's sort of policy or practice now. We wanted to make clear to the public that we would be doing that for sort of obvious reasons. We have a section, and I'll go right to that, where we indicate that the public obviously has a right to have discussions or to make their thoughts known to the board about those issues that are within the jurisdiction of the board, as opposed to issues that may not be within the jurisdiction of the board. As a second step, however, we have indicated, and this is by means of a notice to the public, that there are certain personnel and sort of related issues that the board will not engage in conversations with the public, although the public would still have the right to sort of raise those issues. We just had a discussion, for example, you know, about collective bargaining and how that, you know, might entail. Typically, a collective bargaining discussion is done in closed session, although the board has to act in public session on those. So we have laid out, and these are the exemptions that are actually part of the Open Meetings Act, where in effect the public knows that although you are listening to them, you may not be discussing the issue with them, not because you don't have necessary opinions on it, but because those are more the subject of confidential discussions up to the point that you're making a decision. So we're looking to, in effect, provide a more comprehensive section that deals with public appearances before the board, being clear about what the expectations are, and also providing some pretty specific details about what can and cannot be discussed and what you will engage in. I'm certainly open for questions on this, and we can go from there.
I have more of a comment. I think this is really very important, and one of the comments you made in terms of giving the public the parameters of our response, in light of discussions that have gone on over the past couple of years, I think that's really important. Sometimes the board doesn't respond when the public makes a comment, and in the past, we've been criticized that we haven't been engaging enough, but many times that's because either it's litigation or it's not within the scope of what we can discuss in public at that particular time because of the evolution of where we are. And I think this is very timely for us to be much more articulate as to how a board responds when a public has absolute right to make comment, but it doesn't mean the board has an obligation to be immediately responsive to those comments in a dialogue. And I think this is really, for me, I think this is a very important issue to be very clear. And I think this is the time to do it.
I very much appreciate your comments, and that was the intent behind that particular section and an overall notice to the public about what is expected upon in terms of the public and what they can expect, quite frankly, from the board.
Is there other questions and discussion on the matter? I have a few things I'm interested in talking about. I don't actually have the highlighted version.
Do I?
So I'm not exactly sure what's new and what's. So if it's highlighted, it's new?
It's yes.
So it wouldn't make sense for me to raise concerns. I guess I want to make sure that we're clear when we make a reference to the chair that we're referring
to the committee chair?
To the board chair or the committee.
The language chair that we use is committee chair or presiding officer.
That's in some places. It's not throughout. Sometimes it just says chair. And the subpoint D, the new D, it says members of the public are allowed to register. I think it needs to indicate there with whom they are to register.
Okay, I think that section, and you now have my highlighted version.
Yes, I do. do? Sorry.
That section, we have designated the board liaison. He didn't show up for the meeting on this, so he got this responsibility. I'm kidding. The board liaison office would be where registration would take place.
So if we could just put that there, because that's where someone would want to know who they are speaking to.
Right.
I know it comes later that there's the recording secretary shall confer with the registered speakers. That comes later.
Next paragraph in D.
Yeah, I just want to make sure.
Registration, second sentence, registration should be made with the board liaison or designee.
Gotcha. Yeah, if we could just have that up there where it first says register with. So in addition to that, I have some questions. What is a material disruption?
We went through.
Like this morning?
Throwing people around?
During the past several months, we have gone through extensive consultation on the freedom of expression policy. And part of what we wanted to do on, quite frankly, constitutional law basically indicated you cannot, in a sense, infringe upon constitutional rights unless there is a material instruction. We do not give that definition here. It is hard to really determine. We can make clear here that that can be determined by the board chair or the board fully, but it's going to be a fact-based sort of circumstance. What we wanted to do, and using this morning as an example, what we didn't want any interruption, a slight interruption should not prevent the public from having an opportunity to speak. And so we wanted to have a high enough standard that, you know, if someone is a little bit over or whatever, they would still have that opportunity. But we don't define it here. It's a standard that I think can be applied based on the particular circumstances.
I only asked that question because the prior to that term, there's a number of action verbs, defame, disruptive behavior, make false statements, and then that term then appears. And I'm trying to figure out, I mean, I think there's often times where people speak to us that we think the statements are false. That's not a material disruption.
No. Okay. In fact, those are two separate type issues. One has to do with what your actual statements are, and everyone has a right, in fact, a cause of action for defamation. What we're talking about here is, it's when you're really interrupting, as opposed to, I would say, mere statements. Now, again, we call for in the policy, consistent with what we expect of our students, in terms of the Husky Pack. What we expect of our employees in terms of, you know, an academic institution with robust discussion, but in a civil and respectful manner. And we're very clear about those issues. So, again, we establish a standard here of how that communication could occur. But I don't think that someone making what they believe to be in good faith a truthful statement, which ultimately may turn out not to be, that's not a material interruption.
Mr. Chair, can I ask a quick question, please?
Yes.
Since I missed the meeting, I'd like to ask for a little clarification. In Section D, where it says that the members of the public are allowed to register up to the time posted, mm-hmm. and then in the second short paragraph, it says advanced registration closes 1 hour prior to the scheduled start of the meeting. Mm-hmm. Is that a conflicting statement there?
Or? What we're trying to do there is that we assume that you have to be, you know, in preparation for the meeting so people could still come within that hour and actually register. But having someone responsible for taking those sort of ends the hour before the meeting, but they still have the option of registering at the meeting.
So the distinction is the advanced registration.
Correct.
As opposed to on-site.
Right.
Okay. And as a practical matter, that would come into play if there were multiple people wishing to speak and the chair of the meeting wish to limit the speaking.
That is correct. That's why the provisions that are before you have a section that talks about how best it provides the chair the authority to manage several speakers on the same topic. And so right now it's first come, first serve. But if they want, if the public wants to speak on enrollment, as opposed to any other major, you can actually do that.
This isn't unusual. If anyone's ever testified in Springfield, you know that the chair of the committee will say, we'll have one speaker on the pro side, one speaker on the con side. They'll exercise that level of authority.
Right.
As a practical matter, as long as I've been on the board, we have never had to do that. So I think this is more of a prospective change. I think I've got this. We can empower our general counsel with his notes as I continue. It indicates in H that sign language interpretation is available upon request without prior notice. One, it's in a bracket. Would that bracket be removed? And two, can we actually make this promise?
I didn't hear the second question.
Can we make this promise?
Well, I actually had it in brackets because I really wanted to have some discussion not on on that very issue. I mean, can we, do this? I believe that there's an obligation on our part to do it.
I think so, too.
I think it is the right thing to do, but I didn't want... This wasn't a decision of the General Counsel's office as much as it was. Here is an issue that if we make this representation, we need to be certain that we will be able to comply with this representation.
What does the ADA require?
Greg, do you want to address the ADA on this?
We do have an obligation in our programs and services to provide reasonable accommodations to individuals who have disabilities and make a request for such accommodation. And I believe that's the intent of the statement. It really is no different than what we have in student and employee situations in those contexts. Mm-hmm. If it's not the specifics of the proposed language here, the university does have an obligation to provide reasonable accommodations to disabled individuals who request them.
I think, though, Greg, it's not so much the issue of our obligation, which we all understand. I think what the question is the sense of immediacy. And so is it do can we require notice or, for the accommodation, we have no doubt that the accommodation must be made.
Right.
But it's the language of that sense of immediately.
Well, so yes, we can require notice because that goes to the reasonableness of us being able to accommodate an individual. If an individual just shows up and says, "I can't hear. I would like an interpreter," and we don't have one available. That the reasonableness there is we're going to just say, I'm sorry, that is not reasonable at this point. So asking for advance notice, like 2 days or whatever, is appropriate.
Do we think 2 days is too much, though? Do we need 2 days on something like that?
We have staff on, or we hire the service?
No, we have staff.
We have staff.
Well, there's the issue of when is an agenda item. When can an agenda item be announced to the public? Isn't that 48?
There's a 48-hour requirement on posting of the meeting.
I think you need at least a day to notice the change.
Right.
So maybe 24 hours.
Oops. One thing that I would mention, it isn't realistic to have someone come to the meeting and request an interpreter as far as our staffing goes. We do have some interpreters on staff, certainly, but they're most oftentimes assigned to work with students in specific classes, and so I don't think we could say, all right, we could provide someone because we may then we'll have to take someone from a classroom setting to bring here, and I think that's certainly not what we want to do. The other thing, too, if you're thinking about
hearing loss as an issue. I don't know that I would say always have an interpreter here, because if you want to hit the broader nature of things, a captioner would be far better. We use a captionist in our university council and faculty senate meetings, such that you've got the TV up there and it's just like the evening news, where you know the captioner is getting everything that's said and it's being presented. So, because there are a lot of people who are deaf or hard of hearing who don't use sign language, and so while we might think an interpreter would be, you know, something to bring in, I would argue that you're probably going to be more inclusive if you need to think that way to have somebody as a captioner.
Can I suggest that to just shortcut the conversation that we move to language that we request that individuals who may need reasonable accommodations to participate in the meeting give us advance notice within 2 days, some language like that. And then it would also go beyond, I think, unfortunately, the language used is specific to a type of disability, and we aren't considering all other types of disabilities that may pop up from time to time.
Trustee Strauss.
So I would propose we get rid of the bracketed language and in the paragraph immediately preceding it just change 2 business days to 1 business day. And that is a more general statement with regard to disability, not a particular disability, and it allows for the notice to be posted.
Am I missing something here? That I thought we were talking about more than 1 business day?
Well, we were, but we've decided that because you can announce an agenda item 48 hours in advance of the meeting, that's not really enough time for someone to maybe catch the change. And so if you had 2 business days advance notice, somebody might miss that. So I think one day is better. And it would potentially require us to move more quickly, but it's our obligation.
Maybe I'm missing the whole point. If someone wants to come before the board with a subject, and if that person has some restrictions, it'd be up to that person to tell the board or tell the representative what their needs are. Why should we have to worry about trying to disseminate what their needs are? It's not practical.
All we're indicating is what time threshold, when should they let us know?
Right.
That's all we're indicating.
What's wrong with 2 days?
Well, because because our obligation to announce our what we're discussing and a change in that agenda is 48 hours, we're just giving people time to notice the change so that they can tell us at least a day in advance that they need an accommodation.
I understand that part of it, but if their requirements are just that we need time to react to it, is 1 day practical?
I think so. I mean, I think we've got a building that's been remodeled within a time period that makes it fairly accessible. I think we can accommodate someone within a 1 day period. We can be more specific and say 24 hours.
That's part of the reasonable. We will have to engage with the person on can we accomplish this? We're not required to give exactly what they ask for. We have to engage in an interactive process where we determine, can we provide reasonably what is being requested, or come up with some other reasonable alternative.
We have to have a conversation on the subject.
Yeah, so 1 day.
What is 1 day or what is 2 days, depending on what their needs are?
Correct. So I don't see that as being a practical issue, because we may not be able to do exactly what they want, but we can come up with reasonable alternatives in that time period.
Yeah, I can certainly support the 24-hour versus the 48. I think the critical issue is noticing the public of access to this meeting and providing that. We can be flexible. We want to encourage people to do it as soon as practical. One of the things that the board does is that you publish your meetings by law in December for the entire calendar year, coming calendar year. So at least in terms of your regular meetings, there is notice to the public, and it would be helpful to encourage people to give us as much advance notice as possible so we can accommodate that. So I'm fine with the change.
I just have one thought. When we talked about the material disruption, I don't know if I'm using the same words, but basically the same thing. Have we had any discussions and pre-thought what our response might be if there is material disruption? And I'm thinking about under what circumstances do we call in the campus police? And I want to at least have us think about, maybe not necessarily come to an answer today, but to preempt this so that we don't have any overreaction or underreaction on the effective use of law enforcement, whether it's campus police or outside the campus police. But I think when we use that terminology, and it's a broad term, which, well, it should be, and we have the provisions that are civil in terms of response from a chair, but I want us to at least think about, and again, so that there's no overreaction or underreaction to that. And from your perspective or anyone's perspective, have we had these conversations in the past?
Not as a committee, we haven't. And I think it's a worthy one to have. I mean, I think there's a point at which making an appearance before the board, that's one thing. But then there's protest, mm-hmm. right? And what happens? And my next question is about handheld posters and place cards. I'm not quite sure that would be consistent with our free speech policy, but we can get to that in a moment. But if we do have a situation where we have protest, what are the options that are available to us?
Trustee Muir, Mr. Chair, may I?
Absolutely.
Trustee Muir, one thing I'd like to mention is that we always do have a plainclothes officer in the boardroom at all times. In fact, we have one here with us today.
And don't point him out.
So,
it's just like the air marshals. We're not supposed to go.
So that was all my own.
I think that, again, especially
really
in light
of
societal issues that we're facing, I would like us to at least engage in the thought process of, and I want to continue to use that language of under response or over response.
Trustee Muir, let me share with you, and I don't want to put the provost on the spot, but she and I have been engaged in the past 2-3 weeks in exactly these types of discussions. So I will share with you, and Dr. Freeman, we may want to add a little bit to this. As we develop the policy on freedom of expression, we had conversations that included the Department of Public Safety, Student Affairs, Facilities, the Provost's Office, my office, and we actually established a protocol. I won't go through the details of that, that in effect helped us determine when we would call in the police, what action would be taken beforehand, and who would be responsible for taking that action. We developed a protocol that respected the public, provided them notice that you're now in violation of the policy, provided them an opportunity to comply with the policy. We made a conscious decision not to have the Department of Police and Public Safety making those interactions, but that it would be Student Affairs or the appropriate individuals. And so we had a method by going with it. It was actually instituted this week. My days are mixed up. Last week, where we avoided, I believe, what could have been a challenging, violent situation because of the manner in which it was handled. And we had people who understood the policy, who were told about the policy, but clearly having the public safety department with the authority in the event there was imminent danger being able to take the appropriate action. So we have engaged in that. I think it will be helpful to sort of share that, particularly with the board chairs and committee chairs, and we can sort of do that. And I don't know if the president or the provost wanted to add to that. But.
And I assume there's some at some level, you don't want to reveal all of that information.
I would just say that the policy was developed based on a best practice shared with us by public safety. And the first time we discussed it as a leadership team was actually not in the context of the freedom of expression policy and civil activism, but actually disruption of commencement during the in the convocation ceremony during. So it's a de-escalation protocol that has multiple uses, and we feel very comfortable with it, I think.
Trustee Strauss.
Can I just add that in section 4G, the second paragraph reads, speaker registration must be made during the advanced registration period by the individual who will make the presentation. That's inconsistent with what we talked about in D. Regard to the time, I don't know whether it's advisable to require the person who wants to speak to make the registration, but the time element conflicts internally in this document.
We can eliminate that.
Yeah. So my next question was on K, it's the last sentence, it's the handheld posters and place cards or placards are not allowed in the boardroom during board meetings. I find it hard to believe that's consistent with freedom of speech provisions, and we have had this in the past.
2 points. One is one's expression of freedom of expression in this room is a specific provision that has been provided for the university community, and this is a place where, except when you are in meetings, and it is being used for other purposes, the freedom of expression and the placards, et cetera, it is open. In fact, it's encouraged. It's a specific part of the expression policy and procedure. With respect to the meetings, placards which disrupt, which make it impossible or material disrupt the ability of other individuals to observe your meeting, those types of placards could be prohibited, and that's what we're talking about. So in the course of your meeting, no different than in the course of someone, faculty member teaching, a lab faculty member in a lab, the athletic events, we're still saying there is no right there to have that type of protest. We're saying the same thing here. So, and the second thing is, I think the determination of whether it's disruptive, again, ultimately is going to be that of the board. And we would look to the board chair to do that. But we're really trying to protect the interests of the public, whether they are protesting or not, their right to observe and in some situations participate in your meetings.
So this provides then the option for the enforcement of this provision if the presiding officer of the meeting determines that the postcard or placard is offensive, constitutes a material disruption, prevents people from being able to participate in some manner.
I don't believe that just because something is offensive that you would be able to prohibit that. I do think that if there is a material disruption, what we have advised, for example, faculty on this issue is a student that is protesting who comes to a class is, and they come in their hoodie, as an example, or they have an armband on, that's perfectly acceptable as incidental. Not disruptive in that classroom. I would say the same rule would apply here. But if it gets to be disruptive or it interferes with other persons' rights to be here to observe and participate, then it can be prohibited.
Trustee Strauss. Oh, sorry, Trustee Coleman.
thank you. Recording of meetings. No, there's an Illinois law that provides or says that recordings are allowed. Something just rubs me wrong about the recording and broadcasting of our meeting, even with the full intent to rebroadcast, not only locally, but possibly nationwide. So is there anything we can do about limiting the amount of or the types of broadcasting that can occur? So I didn't know that we were going to be live on a radio show this morning, for example. And so it kind of, there's just something rubs me the wrong way with that. And I don't know.
I think we're being used. That's how I react to that.
That may be true, but let's determine whether there's any way around it.
So there is a difference between recording and broadcasting. The law speaks only to recording, so let's start with that premise. So the allowing of broadcasting directly from your meetings is something within your control. Something to consider. The reuse of thanks, Tony. The reuse of a recording by the public is a area of the law that is actually complicated. The intent behind the law is to allow the public to record public meetings. We do separately record at the same time, and because of that, actually retain intellectual property rights in the recordings of the Board of Trustees meetings. This is the complicated area, to where there could be control over the commercial use of that. However, fair use principles of copyrighted materials would come into play, to where a person could take the recording, go out and do such things as parody or commentary or, those are the two primary, parody or commentary about the board meeting, and they're going to be allowed to do that because of the fair use principle under copyright law. So there are some things that can be allowed, and in fact, I believe the commercial use of the recordings is something that was addressed in the draft. I don't believe, but I could be wrong, that broadcasting was addressed in the draft.
No, we do not specifically address the issue of broadcast, but I would agree with Greg's sort of assessment here. Here's the bottom line. you can probably broadcast. The law, though it doesn't speak specifically to broadcast, I think courts, the Attorney General's interpretation, because this is an Open Meetings Act requirement, it's more likely than not going to be that the recording or broadcasting or use of, and there's going to be few limitations on what could be done. One is you cannot use it for commercial purposes. That's generally what we do with vendors now. They don't have a right, quite frankly, to come and advertise here, et cetera. What we did try to do in the provisions in the policy was to indicate that they could not manipulate the recording in such a way as to be misleading, et cetera. So there's clear language there. We were not, at least I was not aware that there was going to be a live broadcast either. This is an issue that, to be candid, we will probably need to go back and sort of look at, because that type of notice, I think, is more than reasonable. And there is no obligation on the part of the board in the event it really interferes with the continuity of the meeting to allow that. But I don't think that we could prohibit the broadcasting.
Broadcasting or the recording?
You cannot eliminate the recording. It can be recorded, and I think, again, courts are probably going to look at recording in a more broad sense than if you can record it, then you ought to be able to use it, and part of it is being able to hear and understand what has been said and et cetera. So.
Jerry,
trusting your
excuse me.
So am I correct in Illinois, specific to Illinois. You can't record someone unless they know that they're being recorded.
That's an eavesdropping law. It only applies to private conversations, public meetings of public body.
So that was my question. So would a person have to divulge what they were recording at an open meeting? And the answer is no. They can just put it in their pocket and do it.
And in fact, with the use of cell phones,
yeah,
it happens all the time.
Trustee Boy. My reaction to this morning was Mr. Mason was using NIU to broadcast to his listeners. We were being used in that respect that he's getting the attention of people who's listening to his program. I mean, it just enhances his participation of listeners. And he did it purposely. And I was surprised that he was allowed to do it, quite frankly.
Yeah. So what if every month he wants to broadcast live from the NIU board?
I will tell him he could broadcast it live from his office and not in our boardroom, because we have certain rights to it, too.
And I will also tell you, I don't know what kind of show it is, and you know, I don't know what his political agenda is, although it looks like it's beginning to come out.
It's business.
I think we need to strongly look at the live broadcasting. Maybe we can't prevent him from coming in front of us and presenting and recording, but we don't.
But broadcasting.
Live broadcasting, I don't want that to be a regular event, and I don't think I want to be part of that.
We will research this in more detail. This was not an issue that we were aware was going to happen in the fashion in which it was. We were asked whether, in fact, he had the right to record. The statute, the Open Meetings Act, is clear, you know, on that provision. We added the commercial provision, prohibition provision, consistent with what we do across the university. But we will look at this in particular because, again, for commercial purposes, someone wanting to do this every month or whatever, I mean, I think we'd have an issue with other institutions or entities, but we will take a look at that.
It's a dangerous precedent.
Right. Trustee Marshall.
I think the question for me would be his statement or admission that he did have a vested interest, which leads to the question on, does that make it commercial?
He has a commercial interest. Usually with respect to issues of conflict of interest, you're really talking about disclosure as opposed to prohibitions. His right and his and any other's right to speak on issues, notwithstanding the fact that they may have some direct interest in them, would be preserved. And you couldn't prohibit that.
Trustee Strauss.
Two things. First, I hope we can simply allow some further study regarding these issues on recording and broadcasting. I don't think it's productive to speculate any more about that today, but I do believe that we need some further input. And when I first asked for recognition, I wanted to speak to the posters and placards issue that was raised with regard to 4K. So the summary that we had about material disruption and discretion of the chair is not contained in this draft. So to the extent that those are concepts that we want incorporated, then we need to have modifications before this comes back again.
Yeah, and I personally don't, I'm still not convinced that that's a prohibition we should have in this policy. We've seen before people come to our meetings with signs. It was not a disruption. I certainly will tell you in the world that I operate in, when I'm not here, in the labor world, signs are very important and a regular part of peaceful free speech. So I personally would prefer that not be in here. Trustee Strauss.
I'm sensitive to the, you can have a sign and it's free speech as well. I also understand that you could have somebody who had an 8-foot by 10-foot sign that they brought in and nobody else in the room could see through them. So I just think this needs a little more work to be able to try to separate the two out. I'm not in favor of saying people can't bring any written material either. It has happened in the past. It wasn't disruptive. You have no problem if it continued in that vein. My problem is if you have somebody who causes a material disruption, however it is that you define that. So if we could just let people maybe reflect on that and come back to us with another recommendation.
Sure. Do the members of the committee feel they have sufficiently expressed their views and observations about this policy? In this case, can we recommend that this come before the board in an amended fashion?
Yes.
And I will, as the chair of this committee, continue to have dialogue with Mr. Blakemore so that we can have a first reading of this. Again, this will come before the board in December as a first reading, so we'll have plenty of time to talk about its contents.
I'll make a motion to advance this on first reading to the full board with modifications consistent with our discussion today and further research.
Second.
Okay, there's a motion and a second. Is there any further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposition? Seeing none, the motion passes. So the last item that we have on our agenda is an information item. It's a constitutional reform process update. This committee has been discussing this matter since its formation. I believe that I'm referring now to Dr. Long. Slide. Okay, that's it.
Yes.
Are you okay sitting or do you want my seat?
No, I'm fine. Oh, and Holly's going to be my lovely assistant. Thank you. First off, I would like to thank you for the opportunity to give you this update. As Jerry mentioned, this is something we have been working on for quite a while. And I know, and as listed in the agenda, it's constitutional reform process update. And as identified on my slide up here, it's one thing leads to another, inception of a policy library. And really, that's done intentionally to show quite how closely aligned these two projects are. And also with this, my presentation was going to be kind of a lead up for Jerry to talk about the policy on policies. So I will do my best to wrap the discussion around and close it up, but it will be something that certainly needs further elaboration and discussion as it moves forward. All right, so in looking at this, what I want to talk a little bit about is why we're interested in this, what we've done, and kind of where we're suspecting it should go from here. So within shared governance, about a year ago when I had just entered this role, spent a lot of time looking at the Constitution and bylaws and our other governance documents and saw that, with those documents, there were some significant issues, particularly in terms of their specificity and breadth. The threshold required to change bylaws was set unrealistically high compared to many other universities. For example, to change a bylaw, we required 2/3 of the membership of 60 people. To change a bylaw required then 40 people, and our average attendance for the previous 5 years has run about 43 people. So you can imagine that when we took votes, that one or two people, if they just vote no, can in fact influence votes. So in thinking about this, then we thought about we want to revise the Constitution. I think you may have in your handout, in your information, a slide that has a number of, as a figure, do you have that? Yes, you do. Okay. Yeah, thanks. I apologize about the formatting on that. We presented this information to the President's Cabinet a couple of weeks ago. We also presented it to the Rules, Governance, and Elections Committee last week. And preparation to sending it here, there's some formatting problems with it. But that particular slide was simply to emphasize that over the past 3 years, within University Council, we've had a number of votes that, if you look at in terms of popular vote, you know, what does the majority of the body want who's present? You know, we had, as you'll notice on this, 80%, 95%, you know, we had large percentage of the people present wanting to have things endorsed or changed, but because our attendance was low, we would miss votes by one or two, and that was problematic. Now, on the plus side, I will tell you that we have made a change. Our bylaws threshold was amended back in April, and just this past month, we had a meeting of the University Council where the athletic board had proposed a bylaw change in terms of its structure and operation. I mean, minor things, but basically updating. If we had not changed the bylaws, if we had used the same threshold that has been in place for the past 30 years, the vote would have failed by one. We would have had, whereas with our current threshold, it passed by six votes. So recognize that that was a particular concern for us. So when we thought about this idea of revising the constitutional bylaws, one of the problems we have with it is that what do we do with the policies, if you will, that are codified as bylaws, and where would they go? And so that was the discussion that led to the idea that we need some sort of policy library, some place to put these, because you can't just say we want to have a more easily identified and accessible constitutional bylaws by taking out aspects of it without knowing where those go. So that was kind of the origin of this. And as part of this too, the creation of a policy library. I have two slides here just to show you. At the University of Arizona, it's essentially a web portal where policies across the university are organized, so you can do a quick search. They have it both as far as categories as well as an A to Z search index. On this particular one, they also have at the bottom of that page, you know, what's the status of policies, you know, what's in revision, what's being looked at. So for anyone who's interested in that information, they just go to the website and it's there. It's handy. I mean, we have nothing similar at this point at NIU. Purdue, same thing, same idea, just giving you those as examples. Just so you know, from an overall standpoint, we have looked at over 30 different institutions at this point in terms of their policy libraries and approach, and have summarized a lot of that data and shared with the Office of General Counsel. I would reiterate what Jerry and Greg have said, that we've had a very close working relationship, particularly over the last 8 to 10 months as we've talked about this, because shared governance leadership wants to see this happen, and I think you know, larger picture administratively and functioning of the university, we need to have this happen. So it has been a very collaborative process so far. This is, you know, from our standpoint, a very grassroots kind of an effort on our part in collaboration with upper administration and Office of General Counsel. So, as we mentioned, at this point, if we look at university and divisional level, so the higher level policies, they exist in a lot of different places. They exist in the Constitution and bylaws, your Board of Trustees regulations and bylaws, the Academic Policy and Procedure Manual, and across those different documents, there's redundant information. Sometimes there's information that's in conflict. We have, for example, multiple ways of describing how you do administrative evaluations depending upon where you look. That's not a particularly helpful approach. So recognizing that we want to have something that, you know, would allow easier access to policies and have them be organized and consistent in how they're presented, that's, again, where the concept of a policy library comes in. But to do that, it's not just the web portal. It's not just the, you know, here are the categories, but you have to have the guidelines for it. And that's what, when Jerry talks about the policy on policies, we like to talk about it as policy management, but it's that idea of, you know, who creates the policy, who owns it, how is it reviewed, so on and so forth. And those are the discussion points that are included in the draft memo that we would have talked about had time allowed us today, but that certainly need further discussion. And if we look at this, it's not only that we need the guidelines, but there's the bigger picture of, you know, we've talked about enterprise risk management, the compliance and risk features that exist, and if we have policies that are in a number of places, doesn't that put us at some level of risk for being non-compliant and otherwise not functioning in a way that's efficient and appropriate? So those were reasons for it. And thus far, from our standpoint, as I mentioned, our policies are largely, many of them, I should say, are largely codified in our bylaws. Our bylaws are significantly more detailed and have more breadth in them than any I've looked at. And like I said, I've spent the last six, 8 months looking at this stuff. And yeah, ours are pretty unique in terms of how they're organized. And they were also designed at a time to be very resistant to change. So the political atmosphere 30 years ago was different than what we have now, but what they set up 30 years ago has basically presented some serious roadblocks to us as we want to go forward. So in terms of what we've done thus far, I'm in this role. It's a one-year term. I have the possibility of serving 2 years. And so when I began this, I looked at this as a two-year kind of a commitment. And last fall, we were talking very specifically about the Constitution and bylaws and what we needed to do and that we needed to change that voting threshold. And we did. Like I say, we changed the voting threshold for bylaws. And then over the spring semester and summer, we've reviewed the core governance documents in excruciating detail. The Constitution bylaws, the BOT documents, as well as the Academic Policies and Procedure Manual. We've got lots of notes, lots of guidance on those. We also, at this point, and have shared it with the Rules, Governance, and Elections Committee, have even crafted a draft of what a revised Constitution and bylaws might look like, where it takes out all the things that are currently policies, or how we would define policies. So what might that look like? And that draft has been, again, shared with the Rules, Governance, and Elections Committee. But we're waiting to go further on it because, again, in taking the things out of the bylaws, where would they go? Our initial thought would be we would put them in the Academic Policies and Procedure Manual. But again, as board members, I don't know that you've had any direct experience with that, but that's a document that is 80-some separate policies, not searchable and not well-organized and fairly out of date in certain policies. And so that was the thought, that if we were just to put the bylaws and put them in the APPM, that wouldn't be successful, that the faculty who are going to vote on this would say, you know, we don't trust you. And if I were in their position, I would have hesitation too, which is why then the policy library and the management guidelines become so important, because until those policy guidelines, the policy on policy gets established, further work on the Constitution bylaw revision really is that on hold. So we've done all the work for the Constitution bylaws to present it. We're just now waiting on the policy on policies to be put in place and create the structure to support that. So currently, as I've said, we have done at the university council level, we've looked very carefully at all the organic governance documents for the university. We are working with Al Phillips and LaVon Neal to gather policies from other divisions on campus. Our focus is more on the academic and the issues that we can directly address. There's lots of policies that exist elsewhere that, well, we have no direct interest or desire to do further. The eight questions are the ones that are listed on the draft you have from Jerry. What we did with those eight questions is I mentioned that we looked at a number of different universities. We benchmarked NIU's Constitution and bylaws. We also benchmarked our policy library, our lack of one, against others. And when we did that, we identified 14 institutions that we thought did a pretty good job of how they organized a policy library. And so we, the grad students and I, took those eight questions and answered them as they related to each of those separate institutions. And so that was also shared with Office of General Counsel. We've tried to provide as much background as we can on this, because to get the faculty and staff behind this, it not only needs to be a good idea, but we need to show our work. We need to show how we arrived at the decisions. And so that's where we've been going on that. The other thing that we've done on this is, in the process of this, gathered examples of what a policy template might look like. Right now, if we had time, we'd look at the freedom of expression policy. And, it misses a lot of the answers of the eight questions in terms of where is it from, how is it reviewed, how long does it stay in place, et cetera, et cetera. Those things aren't there. Other universities who have policy libraries have a very clear template for how one goes about submitting a policy and how it works. We've gathered some examples of that to share as well. And finally, to make sure that this works, you know, it's going to be web-based, and so we have, I've talked to Brett Coriel, and then at our last meeting of the Rules, Governance, and Elections Committee, he had one of his representatives, Dan Iim, there, and Dan's going to continue to meet with us so that we understand how to best structure this from a web standpoint, such that it's searchable and so forth. Okay. So, as I've said right now, we've, at the University Council level and governance level, we've gathered and reviewed the governance documents. There are many, many others that are out there. I've met with LaVon, Neil, met with Al, talked about how to go about gathering those additional policies and kind of the division of labor, because, you know, they have access and the ability to review and compile information on facilities, on safety, on a number of things that aren't, again, within our purview. We're also needing to, once we have the set, we'll go back to University Council and introduce the change to the Constitution bylaws. And as part of this, also work with the APPM committee, because the policy library will necessarily have to take things out of the APPM and put it where they belong within the policy library. Again, this is an ongoing process. So, long-term success, we have to let people know about this. We've got to pull it off. We have to create a structure that maintains the library. That's one of my major concerns on this. This is a lot of effort that's being directed right now to organize, review, compile this information, but then how does it go forward in a sustainable fashion? And then long run, you know, when we think about the idea of having a policy template such that, you know, policies are submitted in a consistent fashion, they ought to be written in a way that people can read them. Right now, many of our policies are written, no offense, but with a lot of legalese such that our sentences run 30, 40 words per sentence and end up being at the 15th, 16th, 17th grade level. And, you know, if our policies are harder to read than the Wall Street Journal, we have a problem. So part of this is long run thinking about, can we create, you know, once we do the reorganization, because that's the first step following the policy library implementation and the guidelines, can you go back and look at policies and create them in a way that makes sense to people so they can read it? And with that, at this point I would have turned it over to my esteemed colleague and we would have talked more about the draft on the policy on policies. John and Trustee Butler and I and General Counsel Blakemore did talk a little bit before this meeting about the idea of having some ongoing discussions on this prior to the next time we meet, because from our standpoint, within shared governance, I really would like to see this set up by the end of the semester, if at all possible, because we have 4 meetings in the spring semester, and much like you, we have to have a first reading and then an action, and if we're talking about really significant changes to the Constitution and bylaws, which, you know, at first glance, it would appear that's what we're doing, you know, they're reasonable, they make sense, they're logical, but we need to have time to figure out how to roll that out, how to make sure that happens, because my term ends at the end of this academic year, and while I certainly hope whoever follows me wants to maintain this, you know, there's some time limitations here. So my encouragement to you as the board would be to please continue to act on this and, you know, let's shoot for, you know, by the time, you know, we get in the December meeting, potentially have something ready to talk about it in much more detail, because I really cannot take it back to University Council. I can't take it back to the faculty until we have something that I can point to. So that's my quick summary.
Okay. Questions for Dr. Long? All right. Thank you very much for the summary. So the reference that Greg is making is to the memorandum dated October 20th that we have in our materials that was put together by Ms. Blakemore and Mr. Long. So if we could take some time on our own and review this and contact me if you have concerns or things you'd like me to add to the conversation. If need be, we can take this up as a formal item in one of the committees that meets in November. So that concludes our agenda. So at this point, this is where I say next steps. Let's just consider me having talked about that already. Are there other matters to come before the committee? Seeing none, the next meeting date is still to be determined. It'll be in conjunction with the Enrollment Ad Hoc Committee, as has been our custom. Do we have a motion to adjourn the meeting?
So moved.
Is there a second?
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposition? Seeing none, the meeting's adjourned. Trustee Strauss, do you have some guidance for us?
We're going to start right away.